This is Mike Hagan, and you're listening to Radio Orbit. And my guest is Dr. Paul LaViolette. He requires no further introduction. Get on the web and go check him out at www.etheric.com, or just go to my website at mikehagan.com, and you can link right over there to Dr. Paul's sites. And a big thank you to Dr. Paul for sticking around. He's on the East Coast, and it's already 2 o'clock in the morning there. And we had a little difficulty early on getting the phone situation worked out. But he's here with us, and we appreciate it. So, hey, Paul, before the break, I mentioned Archive Freedom, and I think it's a good time to mention that because yeah. it's a really important project, and one that you're directly involved with and sort of the founder of, I guess. But maybe you could tell people a little bit about Archive Freedom for those who don't know, and we can inform them a little bit.
Yeah, it's a collaboration of physicists. Most of us haven't met except through the internet and telephone calls. We're protesting the policy of the Cornell University Internet Archive, which used to be at Los Alamos Laboratory, and they moved it to Cornell because Dr. Paul Ginsberg, who founded it, went mm-hmm. to Cornell. It's become sort of the internet of the physics community for posting papers.
Peer review, all this sort of thing.
Even papers that haven't been yet submitted to journals will be posted there. And the rationale is that it takes so long for a paper to get reviewed. Why wait and, you know, you can communicate to your peers by posting there.
Right. I mean, it seems
in that process.
Yeah, the web seems like a natural venue to exchange and debate and converse about that sort of information.
Right, and it appears that in the past years that the archive has been blacklisting people and preventing them from posting their papers, not because of the papers, but because they somehow decided that they didn't like the particular theories that the people had. So even though the papers, in some cases, they've already been published in peer-reviewed journals, the people are prevented from posting. And, in fact, we even have a Nobel laureate among us whose papers are restricted to a particular category. He's not allowed to post them in the proper category for his papers.
Who is that? Brian Josephson?
Yes.
Yes, yes.
And he's written some articles to Nature magazine about this, which were published. So we are urging people to visit the website, read our stories, which are posted there in the case history section, and to write to your congressmen, senators, representatives, also the House Committee and Senate Committee that deals with science and technology. Mm. And we have a sample letter that people can download, and you could modify it if you like, that you could use to send your comments in. And it's better by mail because with the problem of spam, a lot of the senators and representatives prefer actual hard copy mail.
That's true. I've found that as well.
So if enough people start writing, think of this, you could actually change the future course of science.
Yeah, and this is no small thing because there are advances and discoveries and remarkable things that are coming now fast and furious, and many of them could be, at least it seems, could be really valuable to sort of the population at large, and anybody who's got the grip on that information or a stranglehold on that information and can decide what gets discussed, what gets released, what gets published, what doesn't. That, to me, is just abhorrent to my ideas of free the sharing of information.
Yeah, so we're advocating free access to this archive by serious scientists. We acknowledge, you know, that it's not for the everyday person to post just like on the internet, but right. for people that intend to publish in a journal. this should be really an open process.
Oh,
and if
yeah.
Certain people don't like a person's theory, well, they're free not to download it or not to read it, you know.
Right, and they're free to debate against it in the public forum. You know, I mean that's the idea, I think, as opposed to not letting it even be posted or available for any discussion whatsoever.
Now, just to give an example in my own case, I had a paper that for years I was trying to get posted, which was a prediction of the Pioneer Effect. My theory had predicted it 18 years before it was discovered.
Okay, well, hold on a second here, because that's on my list, too. A listener asked, Dr. Paul, please explain the Pioneer Effect and the solution. So this also ties into the tired light idea that we talked about before. So
right.
we're slowly sort of working our way back to cosmology and this sort of thing. So let's do that. Let's talk a little bit about the Pioneer Effect. Maybe you could take a minute, explain exactly what it is, and how your theories actually predicted the effect itself when it actually did show itself.
Okay, well, I had contacted JPL back in 1980, asked them, is it possible they've seen any blue shifting in their Maser signals sent to the spacecraft?
And that would mean that the signal, a blue shift for the layman would mean that the signal has sped up.
Become higher frequency,
okay.
And they use masers, these are microwave lasers, to communicate with the satellites, with the spacecraft. And the beam, when it's received by the spacecraft, is transponded back to Earth. And by looking at the Doppler shift of the beam, they can determine how fast the spacecraft is moving. So they use this for tracking of the spacecraft.
All right, so they can determine velocity and position?
Right, well, distance from us.
Okay, all right.
Because they can figure how fast it's going, and therefore they know how far away it should be. And they were puzzled as they kept watching this. This was years after I contacted them. They began to realize that there was this blue shifting of the signal, just like I had asked them about,
right.
but they didn't know it at that time. And by that time, they had forgotten, actually, that I had called. And they ended up publishing this in 1998 in one of the physics journals, calling attention to this anomaly, which
right.
they called the Pioneer Anomaly or something.
Or the Pioneer Effect, yeah.
And they interpreted it as a force pushing the spacecraft towards the sun, because if the frequency was higher frequency coming back, that could be interpreted as actually that the spacecraft had a velocity towards Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, the Pioneer is leaving the Earth, so what they mean by blue shifting is their theory is that it's not leaving as fast as they would have expected it.
I understand, okay.
There's some force pushing, whereas my theory comes out of subquantum kinetics and predicts that photons in the galaxy should be blue shifting continually, that the energy is not conserved, that it becomes greater, higher frequency, very slowly. We're talking about 1 part in 10 to the 15th change per second.
Mm-hmm.
1 part 10 to the 18th, something like that. So it's something you couldn't observe in the laboratory, but you would observe it over these long distances.
So is that why you originally had chosen Pioneer to begin with, just to, because it was a suitable object
the only
to sort
way,
of test your
right.
theory?
It was the only way to test the theory.
Okay, amazing.
And I'd read something in a newspaper, in one of the science magazines, that they had masers that were able to detect now these very small changes that they were using for tracking satellites. That's why I'd called them up.
Actually. Right.
So when when I read this, actually I contacted the lead scientist there and sent him my book and told him about the theory. I asked for his paper. He never sent it to me, and I'd gotten sidetracked because I was working at the patent office at the time.
Right.
So I was busy focusing on my work, and I didn't pay it any attention until they came out with their next paper 4 years later. And then I looked more carefully, and I realized that the result they were getting was exactly what I predicted. The amount of the blue shift was what I had predicted way back in 1980, and this was now 2002. So, unfortunately, even though they'd gotten my book, and I had actually marked the page where I described the experiment, I talked about having spacecraft in space and sending a signal from one to the other and back, and that you see this blue shift of X amount, they didn't cite me at all in their paper, which I found a little disturbing. So I felt, well, I have to bring this to the attention of the scientific community, so I wrote up a paper. I submitted it to the journal, but while I was doing that, I sent it to be posted on the physics archive.
Right. Okay. This takes us back to the archive at Cornell.
And it was continually blocked. You're supposed to get endorsed by somebody who's already posting papers, and so I actually got one after another, three different people, and each time they would not take any action. And one of them was Hans Bethe, Nobel laureate,
right,
who was the fellow who had the theory that nuclear energy runs stars.
And you know, for my listeners out there, get on the web and go to etheric.com and page down, and where the first time you see Paul LaViolette's name, and it'll have a blue line underneath it, which is a link to his bio. Go click on it and go read about this man's history and his background and his education, and then use that as a framework, as a reference for the conversation that we're having right now when you hear about the fact that he is, for whatever reason, being barred from posting his ideas, theories, etc., on this particular archive. All right, sorry, Paul, go ahead.
Well, the significance of this blue shifting, people might wonder what is the significance of this. Well, it completely changes all of astronomy if you acknowledge this. For example, red dwarf stars, current theory is that they're burning hydrogen, nuclear energy.
Mm.
When you accept the blue shifting effect, you realize that the energy is not coming from nuclear fusion, but it's coming from genic energies, what I call genic energies, spontaneously created. It's due to this blue shifting. In other words, if you take all the photons in a star, inside the star, and you assume that they're increasing their frequency, every second you will get an excess amount of energy being produced, and that will be radiated from the star.
Now, is that something that's quantifiable from our own star?
In the case of the sun, if you project, now you see the sun is on a different trend line than the red dwarfs. It's on what's called the upper main sequence instead of the lower main.
Right, a different type of star, okay.
And in the case of the sun, it's on the sequence where nuclear energy has kicked in.
Hmm.
See, so that's sort of like the next stage is nuclear energy ignites. And in the case of the sun, if you project up the lower trend line, you see that genic predicts about 10%, and the 90% would be nuclear, which is consistent with the solar neutrino observation.
So in other words, the sun puts out X amount of energy, but it only should put out 90% of what it actually does.
Only 90% is nuclear. The
okay.
other 10% has to come from somewhere else. It's
okay.
coming from the genic.
All right, but is there a conventional or an orthodox a description for where that additional 10% comes from?
There was what's called the solar neutrino deficit. So for a while they were concerned that there weren't enough neutrinos coming from the sun, and therefore that nuclear energy appeared to be less than they'd expected. But then they built some new telescopes, and they found, well, that's not true. There doesn't appear to be a deficit, although to within their measurements, they cannot rule out a 10% contribution from something else. Okay. But the real proof is that you find that Jupiter and Saturn put out heat also. And if you plot their masses and luminosities, how the amount of energy each of those planets is radiating, on a graph, along with these red dwarf stars, you find that they lie in the same trend line. And that can't be explained by current theories. Because current theories are saying the red dwarfs are run by nuclear energy. These heavy planets are due just to heat that they accumulated from their primordial formation, and therefore they're cooling off.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's the case, they shouldn't lie in the same trend line,
right,
and they do.
Right.
Whereas genic energy, the blue shifting theory, predicts that they should. And in fact, that the Earth, the heat from the Earth, is also genic. It's also spontaneously generated. So that geothermal is actually an example of free energy. In other words, energy that's spontaneously being generated this moment.
Hmm.
And that it's not, the Earth is not going to cool off. It's
right.
going to have that perpetually in
right.
the future.
So, well, a couple of things that come to mind, but first off, it's not the sort of engine running down to a heat death. It's more like a...
Yeah, it changes your whole view of the universe,
right.
in fact.
Well, it seems to me, Paul, almost like an organism. In other words, it's like me. It's an open system, and this is one thing that you've written about extensively.
Right, the universe is an open system.
Right, and so as long as there's inputs to that open system, the best description, and I know this is, you know, total heresy in the scientific world, but it's a teleological sort of look at things, that the universe, and this was a question that sort of came up from a listener that I sent to you earlier, that a listener writes, is the universe seeking completion? Is it a process with a beginning and an end? And that to me is a sort of an attractive concept, actually, with the way that you describe
it. It's a philosophical concept, and we are on our time scale is so short here, it's difficult to answer that question because these processes. Look at how far off the tracks modern astronomy is to think that there was a Big Bang. If you read my book, by the time you get to the end of the book, you'll agree. If you're a Big Bang theorist,
right. Paul, that's the thing, and I keep stressing it, but I mean, we're talking to an empiricist on the phone here for the most part. We are talking about a scientist who's fully based in the rational. He's just a scientist that has released preconception and is taking him where the rational search takes him. And that's one of the major differences between you and from many other scientists that I run across, quite frankly.
I tried to think of why is it me that's developing this? Why? There are other people too that are developing new theories, but just to give you an insight in my own case, I tend not to get attached to views, particular views, or belief systems, even religious belief systems. I'm spiritual. I believe in direct inner contact. In fact, the spiritual aspect plays an important part in my life and in my scientific work. In fact, my view of the universe is that it's sacred. It's part of the spiritual domain. So my view on science is that it's an effect us learning more about the spiritual realm.
Sort of the way science was originally thought of. You know, it's sort of from my history, you know, it seems like the current paradigm of science came out of the scholasticism of the Middle Ages with a quite legitimate goal to sort of glorify God, quote unquote, by an understanding of the natural world. Mm. But it sort of it became a pact with the devil and a descent into the underworld of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, religious doctrine tended to crystallize or ossify science.
Mm.
And today, science has done that to itself. The Big Bang Theory can really be considered a religion.
Right.
Because when you send a paper to a journal that challenges it, they don't even want to review it in many cases. I was fortunate to get a reasonably honest editor at Astrophysical Journal, and that's why I was able to publish the paper. But this goes on, and it's science is really, you see that it's in a pretty much of a shambles. If you wonder why science doesn't move forward faster than it does, it's this kind of cabal that controls things.
Right, the hierarchy at the top that is, as you point out, I mean, and we've talked about this before, but it's more it's like a priesthood. It has become a religion of sorts, certain ideas that are just held on to. And, of course, there are reasons why they're held on to, because there are great amounts of prestige and money and tenure and publications and all this stuff that are tied to it, unfortunately.
And, of course, there's the other extreme. There's the people that they get some idea in their head, and it's, of course, very thrilling to come up with a new idea and gives a great feeling. But if you don't question it and don't put it to the test,
right,
and blind yourself that, well, the theory was not correct, because that hurts. You know, when you spent a lot of time developing a theory and then it doesn't work out, it actually, you feel physical pain.
Right, right.
And a lot of people, they don't want to feel that pain, and so they refuse to acknowledge that the theory is not good, and they keep developing it.
Mm. And as you say, they change things to make the data fit, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And you have to be able to self-criticize your work. Right. I've been off track several times, and it was only by admitting that the theory was wrong that then I saw the correct path, and you're able to go forward.
Well, it's no different than any endeavor in life. You know, when you're on the right track, be happy and keep moving forward. When you're not, and you realize it, recognize it, and then try to make a course correction, so to speak. You know.
But getting back to Archive Freedom, so I urge everyone to contact their congressman, and hopefully we can change the situation.
Yes, and there are a number of stories there. Dr. Paul's is one of a bunch of them. Dr. Carlos Castro is another one who some of my listeners may be familiar with. I talked to him last year. He has another very interesting story. I've had conversation via email with Dr. Brian Josephson, who Paul mentions, who's a Nobel laureate, and. Anyway, these are serious people with great achievement and accomplishment in their own pasts, and have good reason to be asking the questions and writing the papers that they're writing. And there's no reason, at least none that I've come up with, that makes any sense to not allow them to do that. So
I should say, in my own case, finally, they allowed me to post in the physics section. I had gotten National Science Foundation calling them, because Ginsberg actually gets money from National Science Foundation.
Go figure.
But still, I'm restricted to the physics section.
Mm.
And this particular paper belongs in general relativity quantum cosmology section, which is where the Pioneer Effect is discussed. And I've refused to post it until I'm allowed to be posted there.
Right.
Which is unfortunate, because now is the LISA project is coming up, where they're going to put a laser interferometer up, and the scientists, there's a whole group of scientists at JPL and other universities scattered around the U.S. and other countries who are working on this project, and they had no idea of this blue shifting effect, because it's going to affect their measurements.
Right, right.
And I had to really only through insistence to contact the people there directly. You know, the head of the program said, well, why don't you just put your, write up a paper and stick it on archive, on the Cornell archive. And that's the problem. You know, I would have liked to do that, because I was proposing they have to make allowance for this effect.
Right.
And they may even need to make sure that physically their satellite can detect the blue shifting. But to do this, you have to communicate to discuss the ideas with other scientists.
Right.
And that's only discussed on the quantum cosmology section. So I'm hoping to present directly to them in Washington, so I think the idea will still get to them, but it really has been a lot more difficult.
Oh yeah,
than it should be. You know, and these are projects. This, for example, is funded by your taxpayer money.
Yeah, and as you say, I mean the ideas that you came up with the frequency shift were originally discovered 25 years ago, and have been presented a number of times to the establishment. And as just sort of a side note, anecdotally speaking, and I think you know of at least a couple occasions of this, but there have been at least two, and I want to say three, articles that have come out in PhysOrg or New Scientist or, you know, some of the scientific magazines on the web and in print over the last year or so that have talked about the Pioneer effect and what a big question mark it is. Well, in each one of those cases, I've emailed the author of the article and included reference and materials to your work, and not one time have I ever received a reply.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, because I mean I'm certainly gracious enough and you know, and treat them with respect, and your work is not the work of an amateur by any means. I mean it is certainly as high a caliber work as anything else that's out there. So I was amazed at this, and then I thought, well, God, the stuff that Dr. Paul is going through is not it's not BS. It's legitimate, and it seems to be sort of widespread.
And you know, unfortunately, I don't have unlimited patience,
right,
which is really required for such a thing. And you know, I will do a certain amount to get the idea out there the best I can. And you know, I can't keep pushing on the wall, on a stone wall forever.
Yeah, I mean, you have a life to live. You have your own concerns, so no question about it. And well, let's just finish up with Archive Freedom and mention the website again, archivefreedom.org. Paul, this idea of the Big Bang, maybe this is why there's such a resistance to your work on the Pioneer problem, is because am I correct in assuming that once you accept this blue shift and this particular cosmology that you're talking about, then the Big Bang falls, right?
Right. The where you would have blue shifting within the galaxies, the same theory predicts red shifting outside the galaxies.
Why is that? What's the difference between intergalactic space and then within the galaxy?
It has to do with gravity.
Okay.
So we're in a gravity well here in the galaxy. If you go outside the galaxy, you go into a gravity hill region. In other words, if you think of a rubber sheet, in, you know, the idea of mass sort of creating wells in it. Now, in this theory, this is something that's not in standard physics, but it's, it comes out of subquantum kinetics. Gravity affects the conservation of energy, so that if gravity is very negative, you have blue shifting going on.
Okay.
And the opposite, if it's very positive, potential is very positive, you have red shifting. It's not arbitrary at all. It's actually, you can simulate on the computer. You put the equations in the computer and predict the same thing. Think of a nuclear reactor, because you're dealing with a nonlinear system.
Okay.
And that the reactor is supercritical, or space, think of space, is supercritical inside the galaxy, and it's subcritical outside the galaxy.
Okay.
And so the basic concepts are right out of nuclear physics. And so the redshifting is an alternative to the idea of expansion.
Mm-hmm. So what does that tell us about the nature of galaxies and the, I won't even go so far as to say the universe, but as far as, you know, our little corner of it, what we know with regard to creation and the way that, that things come about. In other words, the Big Bang sort of says that everything just, for no reason whatsoever, really.
The Big Bang has the violation of energy conservation occur all at once.
Right.
In a big way.
Right.
Whereas in this cosmology, it's much more, you're dealing with much more modest creation.
One atom at a time, sort of, or one...
Throughout the universe, yeah, that you have the possibility of particles materializing.
Mm.
And the theory explains how this occurs. It comes out of the zero-point energy, as it's called, the fluctuations that are going on even in empty space.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then you get a fluctuation that's large enough that creates a seed out of which a particle can form.
Mm.
And then the reactions, the matter creation rate, this is like continual creation cosmology.
Right, that's the idea, continuous creation.
The matter creation rate goes on at the fastest rate inside the mass at the center, the core at the center of the galaxy, or at the center of each galaxy, because, again, it depends on the gravity potential. That you have a very deep gravity well there, so you have a very supercritical region, so not only you have a lot of energy being created, but matter also.
Mm.
So actually, most of the matter in our galaxy is being created at the center, as it turns out.
Okay, so we've come full circle, though. We're back at the center. We're back at the galactic core, and
right. This puts a whole new view on these core explosions. What are core explosions?
Right. What are they? I mean,
they are the big bangs, so to speak. In other words, there's not one big bang. It's many big bangs going on in the centers of galaxies, and it's the process of creation. So the Big Bang theorists got that right, that there are explosive events that are creative, but they got the location wrong and the timing wrong. maybe there is an intuitive aspect that leads people, but they got down the wrong path, the way I see it.
Hmm.
And so this is the birth pangs of the universe, of the galaxy in this case, of our own galaxy. It just goes through periods where the creation process gets out of hand. It gets too supercritical, and you have an explosive outburst that blows a lot of matter out from that region.
Mm.
And once that matter is cleared out, the gravity potential comes back to more normal levels, and so the process subsides.
Right, and as always, you have creation and destruction sort of in the same breath.
Yeah, and it's a cyclical phenomenon, because the process is always going on, and you'll build up again matter at the center, and it will again explode.
All right, okay, so let's let's move just a little bit further. I've had you longer than I ever expected to, so I'm going to ask you a couple more questions about your book, Talk of the Galaxy, because that's one that I've been involved in just recently. I just finished it on Saturday, and it's the second time I read it, but as I mentioned to you off the air, it really struck me the second time more than the first time, because I'm more familiar with your other theories, and this sort of involves them. But to make a long story short, pulsars, this particular sort of stellar phenomena that we see, you have an idea about them and what they are. Let's talk really quickly about what that idea is, and go from there. And we've also already began speaking about the radian markers, so we'll definitely touch on that as well, of course.
Okay. I believe pulsars are artificial beacons. They're of extraterrestrial intelligence origin. And you conclude that from a number of things. First, they're the most complex phenomenon known to astronomers. They humble astronomers. they're so complex. In fact, the people that are working on them admit, I have in my book quoted some passages where they admit that there is no real theory that they can come up with to explain what they're seeing.
Hmm.
Can think of complex computers out there spitting out information, that's close to the idea. I have a whole chapter where I talk about the complexity of the signals. First of all, it's the most... Okay, for example, we do see pulsating phenomena out there, like pulsating stars, but these are rather erratic. Like if you study the period of the star, it's going to vary over time. Pulsars, if you study that, they are highly precise to 15 decimal places or more. And they're profile. What are they? Okay, so the question is, what are they? They're
right.
What we see are broadband radio signals. They're not discrete signals like TV stations. They spread this over the whole spectrum. So we pick them up with radio telescopes. So no matter what frequency our telescope was tuned to, it would see these, which is convenient. That's one thing you'd want to do if you were sending out signals, and you wanted to your source to be seen. They accumulate many pulses to build up what's called a pulse profile. So astronomers plot the pulsar's profile, in other words, how the radio intensity varies with time, because first of all, the period of these things can go from just a little over 1/1000th of a second up to 11 seconds.
Which means they're spinning very, very fast.
Well, that's the standard model, that there's a star spinning that causes this pulsation.
Ah, okay, so this is the lighthouse model that we're
talking about. That's the lighthouse model that was proposed. Actually, when they first discovered the first pulsar, they thought they discovered extraterrestrial communication.
Right, it sort of meets all the criteria, as you said earlier, about what we would look for or what we would expect to find if we were looking for something that was artificial. It has all of those signals, but then it just sort of got, as always, it's sort of like... be careful what you wish for, and then the paradigm kicks in and says, oh my gosh, we can't accept that particular possibility. Now we have to try to explain it away.
Well, already, this occurred in the 60s. Already there was the program to discredit UFO observers and so on. So scientists were very hesitant to come out and say they discovered something like this that was of extraterrestrial origin.
Right.
And then they found... Three more, and then these were in different parts of the galaxy. So at that time, they thought it unlikely that once civilization would be broadcasting from so many places, they'd never thought the idea of a galactic civilization, a community let's say, galactic community.
Right, with sort of a communications network or something like that.
Right. And so somebody suggested this lighthouse model.
Mm.
And originally they had the idea of a pulsating star, radially pulsating. But then that couldn't explain what they were seeing. But then they came up with the idea of the neutron star that it would be spinning, causing this. And I show in the book reasons why that has difficulty.
Yeah, just to make it short, it's a way over super simplification.
Right.
If you're interested in the details, get Talk of the Galaxy, and it's available at etheric.com and at 1-800. Let's see, what's that number? 715-9993. So the pulsar is a very, very strange bird up there.
So the question is, what is it if it's not a spinning neutron star?
Okay, what your idea is?
What I'm proposing is there is a neutron star there that's radiating cosmic rays. Or in some cases, it might be a white dwarf or a X-ray star. The important thing is it's a source of cosmic rays, cosmic ray electrons. And what the civilization has done is project a force field disk to the surface of the star and energize the disk so that it decelerates the cosmic rays that come off the star. And what that does is it causes them to radiate radio emission called synchrotron radiation.
Synchrotron radiation.
And that would be beamed, would form a beam. So in other words, these beams, there are beams, but they're not spinning. They're stationary beams. And the ones that we're seeing, the pulsars we see, are beams that are directed towards us, towards our part of the galaxy.
Hmm.
And they are flashed on and off. They are modulated electronically. And with the proper electronics, they can create these very complex patterns. If you think of a TV picture being built up from scans, from the scans across the screen,
mm-hmm.
that sort of describes what a pulsar is.
Hmm.
The profile, that's the very constant part of the pulsar, is built up from hundreds or thousands of individual pulses that are
right.
received.
Right.
The pulses themselves vary around, but the overall picture is very constant. You can't explain that with a spinning neutron star.
Mm.
That is an indication of intelligence when you get that type of thing happening.
And from my reading, it appears that the closer you look at these things, the more deeply embedded the order seems to be. In other words, it's a highly ordered system, but the closer you look at it, there are pulses, smaller pulses in between larger ones, etc., that are all also highly regular and very difficult to...
Right, they call it subpulses, subpulse modulation. At different phases in the pulse profile, you'll have oscillations of pulses, you'll have drifting of the pulses, you'll have mode switching where the whole character of the pulsar suddenly changes.
Right, right.
The actual pulse profile becomes entirely different.
And then shifts back.
And then we'll suddenly shift back. There's some that have actually five modes. Each mode has a totally different pulse profile, and it will flip from one to the other. Some have actual logic that will go from one state to the next in a certain order, but it will go never in the reverse. Some cases they'll shut off entirely. They'll go dark. You won't see them.
Really?
Suddenly pop up, and they'll leave off where they were before.
Huh. Okay.
It's almost like a tape recorder.
Wow. All right. So there are lots and lots of reasons why these things are really extraordinary.
Yeah. Now, and I detail this in the book.
Yes, yes.
But it takes a lot of careful reading to piece all these things together. But the part that's probably the most convincing and easiest to understand is the locations of certain of these pulsars, the most unusual, are located in key spots in the sky.
Yes, okay, and this takes us again back to what we spoke about a little bit earlier in the program, this idea of the radian. Let's clarify that again for everyone.
Okay, the galactic one radian point, which is one radian from the galactic center, from our vantage point looking there.
As if we were the center.
In other words, at galactic longitude 57.24 degrees, approximately.
Okay.
And you find that of all the pulsars, there's more than 1,500 that we've detected in the sky. And if you grade their rate of pulsation, you take the fastest pulsing pulsar in the sky. Where does it happen to be? It
right
ends up being closest pulsar to this one radian point. It's only 0.4 of a degree from there.
And that's on the, again, from our viewpoint, there. If we're looking at the galactic center, there would be a radian point on either side of it, correct?
Right. And this is at the one, it's where the arrow is.
Okay, so this is where Sagitta is.
Sagitta, right. Except Sagitta is a little off of the plane, but this is right on the, very close to the equator.
Okay.
And it's only a quarter of a degree of longitude from that one radian point, and in terms of direct arc is 0.4 of a degree.
What does that mean to you as an as a physicist as far as accuracy?
Oh, it's incredible.
Okay.
In terms of what is the chance that the fastest pulsing pulsar
would lie in that position?
As it had all these unusual characteristics, not only the fastest pulsing pulsar, but it's also one of only five or six, that put out optical flashes.
Which, of course, is a universal sign for sort of look over here.
Right.
Or at least on this planet it is.
Because the majority of the 1,530 pulsars that they observe are radio pulsars. So this small set are putting out optical flashes, including the Vela and Crab pulsars, which the other two unusually placed pulsars, they mark the closest supernova remnants to us that were detonated by the last superwave.
And again, in the book, there's evidence of that, that those particular supernovas in the Crab Nebula and Vela were actually supernovas that occurred because of the impact of the of a recent superwave that emanated from the galactic core.
Right. So you realize that they're trying to call our attention to this past event, and it's something that would have affected all life in the galaxy, and it's a natural thing to communicate if you're going to be discussing something with another civilization. If you just talk about where we are located on Earth like we did on our space flight, some galactic civilization will suddenly realize, well, these people know nothing about galactic superwaves, or at least they would have mentioned something on the space plaque, which is the most important phenomenon that affects all civilizations.
Right. So it's something that, regardless of your civilization, it's something that all civilizations in the galaxy have in common, because they've all experienced in the past this this superwave.
And here I will disclose that actually deciphering, realizing about these two supernova remnants that were marked by these pulsars was part of, it was an important step in my realizing about the superwave theory.
Huh.
Because on the one hand, I mentioned earlier, I had discovered the marking of the date that the galactic core had exploded using the zodiac constellations, sighting.
Right.
But when you first understand that, you don't immediately get the idea of a wave moving out, you see. you see that something is marked in the sky, but you don't get the 3D effect of this thing coming at you. But then when I saw these two supernova remnants were marked in such an unusual fashion with these flashing beacons, one is the brightest pulsar in the sky. That's either the Vela or the Crab. I think it's the Vela, the brightest. And the Crab pulsar is the most luminous of all.
Right.
And for those I call them the king and queen of the pulsars, to be marking these two supernova remnants, it really calls your attention. And that's what got me to look at their dates of their explosions and realize, hey, these were sequentially triggered by an event that moved at the speed of light away from the galactic center. And that's when I realized it was this cosmic ray front with possible gravity wave component.
Right, and there's even imagery that shows the bow shock of it moving through those one of those nebula, at least.
Yeah. So.
Wow. Okay. Well, look. So we've got. So it's possible that again, that's where the name of the book comes from. It's the talk of the galaxy. Of course, that's what everyone would be talking about. And
now they're changing the title. It's being reprinted in a new edition under a different title, so people will be aware of that. That will be coming out probably in May. It's called Decoding the Message of the Pulsars. And it'll be essentially the same as Talk of the Galaxy, but updated.
Right, there's some new information in there.
And I have some of that on my website, some of the new findings.
Wow. Okay. Well, Paul, we've kept you on the line an hour longer than we expected to because we had sort of a late start, but I cannot tell you how much I appreciate it. The time goes really quickly. It's nearly 3 o'clock your time, and boy, this is one that I can't wait to get off the digital computer here and get it up on the archives and on the web so other people can listen as well, and we can share it with other people because, as I expected, it's just been fascinating and important, really astonishing and relevant information. So,
and also mention there's a video, too, of Talk of the Galaxy that's available.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
That was my presentation to the American Astronomical Society where I announced these findings.
Huh.
And discussed with some astronomers in the exhibit hall.
I love it. What's outside?
You haven't seen it? I can send you a copy.
I would certainly love to see it. And let me ask you a question. Outside of the public eye or whatever, what sort of response do you get from other scientists like yourselves when you show them the data? I mean, that's what it comes down to. You show them the data and say, hey, look.
Yeah, that's on this video because I'm pulling over people. Actually, half of the astronomers weren't interested in extraterrestrial communication, so you had to rule those out.
Right.
I guess they were just interested sitting in front of TV screens processing data but weren't really interested in these big questions. And then the other half, was about two-thirds of them, were interested to come over and take a look and were open-minded enough to take a look at the evidence. Because once you see the evidence, I mean, because this is, it's not like a UFO sighting that it's gone and it was, you know, you have to depend on people's reports. This is stuff that's been cataloged and there's no question that it exists.
Right, and it's still there and it's constantly available for verification.
And you just look at some of these, like there's the pi relationship is shown between the two fastest pulsars. There's both the there's a pi relationship. There's a 2 pi relationship. There's things encoded in the periods of the two fastest pulsars.
Hey, you know, since we got a quick minute here left, there was a question that I had actually regarding that particular pulsar that's called the EBM, or so designated, the EBM pulsar.
Eclipsing binary millisecond pulsar.
Yes.
Which is the second fastest pulsar in the sky.
And its period is 1.6, oh, I forget exactly the measurement or whatever, but I was immediately thinking about the golden mean. Does that have anything to do with this, or is that just...
Well, that's milliseconds now, so you... If there was some significance for the millisecond, you know, but we don't have a guarantee that.
Right, it's hard to say what the
other civilization
are using
would
the same time
thinking that way.
I see. All right,
I've come up with a lot of questions like that, and then you end up saying, "Well, that's sort of
based on our frame of reference."
Yeah,
and
yeah, just an idea, and doesn't seem to could really be something we pay attention to seriously. But some of these other things do catch you.
Yeah, I mean, and as you've shown, they're measurable.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, we have interesting times for sure. The galactic core, the last time it exploded was, what's your best guess?
The small explosion was about 700 years ago.
And there was
outburst or burp or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And the last major one was about 12,000 years ago, so between 11,000 and 16,000 years ago.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll keep our eyes on the skies and keep trying to learn about this stuff. The gamma ray bursts are just fascinating to me, and more and more scientists other than yourself are recognizing the connection between these greater cosmic events and events here on Earth. I read a story just yesterday about cosmic rays influencing the atmosphere and the likelihood of cloudy days, believe it or not. So the stuff is slowly making it into the mainstream, but your ideas are well ahead of the pack, as they have been for 30 years now. So,
thank you, Mike.
Paul, I can't tell you. Thank you very much. Fascinating stuff, and we'll continue our correspondence, and I'm sure we'll have some questions that arise from this particular show, and I'll forward them to you, and we'll make everything available online as we always do, okay?
Okay.
All right. Hey, I'll be in touch, and as always, Paul, thanks again, and I'll give out the information for Dr. LaViolette's websites one more time here. You can get everything that we've talked about tonight at www.etheric.com. And also make sure you check out archivefreedom.org. And you can always access Dr. Paul's material and websites from my website as well. So, well, here we are. Thank you, Dr. Paul, one last time. And take great care of yourself, all right?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. All right, everybody, there you have it. Dr. Paul LaViolette, and a great thank you to him for staying up until 3 o'clock in the morning on the East Coast to share his amazing information with us. I'll be back next week with John Major Jenkins. We'll talk about the Mayan calendar and what might be coming up in the year 2012. We'll finish things off here with a little bit of music. This is Robert Carty from a few weeks ago. The song is called Infinite Waves. And it goes out to my friend Tim, who passed away and moved to the other side on Friday, and also to my friend Dr. Paul LaViolette. I'll be back next week. This is Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit.